Welcome to Leaders in Sustainability, a podcast series by Trianon Scientific Communication. Hello, hello, wherever you are, whenever you're listening to this, this is Science by Trianon, a podcast by Trianon Scientific Communication.
Hello.
And we've got with us Nicole Reynolds today. She is the go-to expert in all matters of climate finance and impact funding. Hello.
Hi there. Thank you for having me today.
It's a pleasure.
It's our pleasure.
And as the last podcast, we're having also Loan today. Hello, Loan.
So let's barge right in. Nicole, who are you? What is your background? What do you do? And how did you come to be doing what you are doing?
Sure. I've been working for about the last 25 years at the intersection of finance and development. So I started my career on Wall Street and in corporate development in New York and London. And I had always had an interest in emerging markets and innovation and all things new. So, you know, I eventually took all of that experience that I gained working in finance and pivoted to working in international development, which is kind of what I really went to school for. I went to the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University in New York, where I studied business and finance and emerging markets. And so finally, after a long career in the private sector, I decided to start working on tough international development problems. And one of the things that kept coming up for me was, how do we finance infrastructure, and how do we channel more patient finance to companies in developing countries so that they can grow and upgrade their standard of living and enjoy their lives more than they currently do. So that's what led me to ESG and sustainability, this interest in things that are new and innovative and new ways of looking at old problems. And so since then, I've been working in climate finance and ESG broadly in helping to solve sustainability challenges that we face as society.
Okay, thank you. Luan, go please.
Sorry. So can you explain us a little bit more what is climate finance and what does it mean?
So in order to bend the curve of sustainability back to a sustainable level, we need to invest a lot more in infrastructure, particularly for power generation globally. And the countries that are being more affected by climate change are really the poorer countries in the world. So if we're going to develop these countries, we need to invest more in power generation capabilities and more in sanitation and sustainable agriculture in order for them to leapfrog where we are in the West and get on a more sustainable path going forward. You know, we've had 150 years of industrialization, which has not been kind to the planet. And so if we're going to all live together in a sustainable way going forward, we need to invest a lot more in the infrastructure that will allow these countries to enjoy a good standard of living going forward. So climate finance is really about finding adaptation and mitigation solutions to the current ways in which the economy is organized.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, so as a consultant, you worked for various multinational corporations, SMEs, government agencies, and investor groups focused on economies in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, and of course from your LinkedIn profile here. Where would you see the similarities and the dissimilarities between these four different groups of players in these three different regions?
Talking broadly about sustainability and specifically about ESG, what they all have in common is that they're all stakeholders in moving the world towards a sustainable future. They all have a role to play in addressing climate change, and they should all have a seat at the table to co-create solutions. But they're different in terms of how much they're affected by climate change and how much responsibility they bear for the current situation. So therefore, the roles that they play in finding the solutions are also different. Governments generally defend the rights of citizens, and companies generally defend the rights of shareholders. Their mandate is to generate returns and profits. So the trick is to get each stakeholder to understand that their interests do align and that they need to care about the interests of the other parties involved. Addressing sustainability, especially climate change, demands that we all think in terms of mutual interdependence and not, instead of living in silos, it's not a zero-sum game. Each party has responsibility and potential benefit from finding solutions to these problems.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So in your opinion, how would you define what is an impact investment?
Impact investing.
Yeah.
Impact investing classically means supporting a sustainable goal, a societal goal, in addition to creating a financial return. Now, it's actually gotten kind of a lot of bad press lately because people think it defines philanthropic way of investing. But in fact, it seeks to find challenges to problems that we face as a society while using mechanisms of the market. It's very attractive to, you know, governments and policymakers. Investors maybe are less convinced, but the ones that say, yes, I want to give up potentially part of my return in order to create a sustainable future, will find this an attractive way of doing so.
So would it be correct to say climate finance is about environmental sustainability and impact investment is about social sustainability?
Yeah, I think that would be a good way to describe it. You know, first and foremost, climate finance really is about helping us figure out how to develop infrastructure that supports reduced greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We all know that the burning of fossil fuels over so many years has created a situation where the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere is too high. And we need to figure out better ways to generate power that don't do that. So it's going to involve finding new ways to build infrastructure that reduce that concentration, as well as allowing us to use less power going forward. So climate finance really is about adaptation and mitigation and finding a way to produce a lot less greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. Whereas impact investment is, I think, more focused on social issues. And it can also have a climate impact and a climate component, but I think it's more about supporting social initiatives.
Okay, but as it is still possible to make money with unsustainable investments. A particularly crass example is perhaps coal-fired power station somewhere in Vermont, I think, that was supposed to be taken offline and has in fact been taken over by crypto miners who continue to belch out vast amounts of CO2 for no other benefit than their own bitcoins. What, in your opinion, could or should be done to prevent this?
First and foremost, I think sometimes this is a situation where you have innovation and new technologies outpacing regulation. So there's nothing right now that's really regulating cryptocurrencies and the creation of crypto mining. So it's something that it's an uncharted kind of territory. And so there's nothing that says you can't do it. So people have found a way to continue to do it, and they need vast amounts of power to do it, meaning electrical power. So I think there's definitely a place for policymakers to step in and start to take a closer look at this. But in terms of the greater economy, the larger economy, there's still a huge demand for petrochemicals and coal and dirty fuel sources. We're looking at 150 years, 170 years of industrialization built on the burning of fossil fuels. So it's really, really hard to pivot that overnight and change it to something more sustainable. The sustainable sources simply don't have the reliability and the capability of generating the quantities of power that we need when we need it to run the world economy as it is. Now, we can have a debate about whether or not we need to change the world economy to something better, something more sustainable, and that's a valuable discussion, but we're just not there yet. Secondly, I think I would point out that the way portfolios are managed simply cannot replace oil investments overnight. This is something that I don't think gets talked about enough, which is that petrochemical companies, oil companies, tend to be some of the most profitable and stable industries in that you can invest in. They throw off a lot of cash and they do it reliably and sustainably. Therefore, their stocks are not as volatile as growth stocks, you know, technology, for example. So if you're a portfolio manager and you're trying to generate returns with a given level of risk and you sign a mandate with the asset owner to do this, so the asset owner says to you, I have this money, I want to invest it, here's what I want you to do with it. They're looking at this going, okay, I need to generate a certain level of return for a certain level of risk. And oil companies are super stable and allow me to hit those targets. So if you suddenly take oil out of all the portfolios globally, you have to find another asset to allocate to that's as stable as oil, generates the same level of return for the given level of risk. It's not easy to do that. I mean, this is changing. Slowly, the world is pivoting, and some of the leading voices that are leading this charge are, in fact, asset management companies like BlackRock. Their portfolio is so big that there's nowhere in the world that they can't invest and not be exposed to climate risk, because they're basically, their returns track the economy because they're so large. So if those companies are now saying, okay, if we're going to get onto a sustainable path, we need to really force this change, if only to insulate their own performance, that's not a bad thing. The other driving force is also, you know, consumers and customers, investors like you and me, and pension funds and insurance companies, because they're also being hit very hard by climate risk in their portfolios. So, you know, we're getting there, but we're not there yet. So, you know, like I said earlier, there's an element of regulation that needs to happen to prevent some of these kind of outlier industries like crypto to continue to consume large quantities of power. But then the change really needs to come from the people with the money, and that's really all of us in the real economy and investors and savers who are going to now say, look, we need to consider these climate risks, because if we don't, there won't be a future for any of us.
Very true. As we've already touched upon, as of late, ESG has become a bit of a bad word. BlackRock, for instance, don't want to use it anymore. What, in your view, is good about ESG and what could be improved?
I think ESG gets a really bad rap in an unfair way, because ESG is not about prioritizing certain aspects of risk and certain factors in investment decisions. It's about including more risks that we previously have not considered before. And that's particularly true for climate. ESG says, look, all of the things that we do when we invest and when we buy things have knock-on effects. It's not just a sort of linear situation where, you know, we make this investment and that investment stays contained to one activity. These things, as I said before, are interconnected, and there are effects on the companies and then on society itself. So ESG seeks to include all the risks that we currently have ignored in our investment decisions. So it's not about prioritizing diversity or prioritizing the environment or prioritizing good governance practices. It's about being really inclusionary of all the risks that we face. So I think if we did that, we would see that, in fact, we can bend the economy and markets to a sustainable future if we properly price in all the risks that we're truly facing.
Okay. And so, in your opinion, what is the more important, supporting startups doing the right things or regulating the big players?
Wow. I think it's really great to support startups going forward to develop new innovations and new methodologies that help us face these risks, but they're not the ones creating the current situation. It's really the big established players. And sort of a parallel to that is saying to, you know, the developing world, well, you have to become sustainable because your population is growing so fast that you're going to push us over the limit. Developing countries didn't create this problem. We did in the West and in developed economies globally, whether it's Australia, Japan, to some extent China, certainly the US, North America, and Europe. We created this problem. So it's really up to us to solve it. So for big companies, they're the ones with the power and the biggest footprint, the biggest carbon footprint. So it's up to them to lead the charge on solving the future challenges.
Okay. Now I'm going to go back more to the framework and the landscape of finance. Why are women or diverse investors so few?
You know, I think it's because women haven't been traditionally included in finance generally. There just aren't that many of us who, you know, came up the ranks from training programs and investment banks and have gone on to become the big decision makers at any level. So women are underrepresented in the ranks of managing directors, in the ranks of board members, in the ranks of CEOs. And, you know, it's just not been that easy for women to make inroads and to break in. It's the same reason that women aren't big investors and in big decision makers in venture capital, for example. Women have not traditionally been the ones who've been funded by venture capitalists, had big exits and then had tons of money that they could then turn around and invest in young promising startups and then become VCs themselves. So it's a vicious cycle of women just having a really hard time breaking in from the lowest levels of finance up to the levels of decision makers. And it's changing, but it's not easy. And I honestly don't have a lot of great answers as to how we do change it. I guess we just have to keep making the point that diverse teams make better decisions than non-diverse teams. And that's been shown in academic research over and over and over again. So we just have to keep fighting for inclusion.
Okay,
we couldn't agree more.
Yeah, yes, we couldn't. So Luan, you had a question now.
Yes, so on a more personal note, as a woman in finance, what were your challenge for change in general?
My challenges, well, yeah. You know, I think I was always treated differently than the guys in the group. I was never really one of them. They always, you know, sort of would pick on me or, you know, look at any mistake I made and make an issue of it, whereas a guy would get a pass for making the same mistake. It's just something that took a really long time to figure out, that if I tried to behave like the guys, then I wasn't treated the same way, and in some cases treated more harshly. And, you know, I never grew up with the notion that I should behave differently because I'm a girl. You know, in class, I was always the first one to raise my hand to answer a question. I never had any fear about being bigger or larger, taking up space. But when you get into the workplace and you continue with that same action, sometimes it isn't met with the reaction you expect. You expect to be treated the same as the men, but you're not. And it leaves me scratching my head going, well, gee, why didn't that work? And again, I don't have a good explanation for how we solved this, but I do think it starts with really teaching young kids from the age of 5 or 6 that, you know, girls can grow up to be anything they want, and that because girls do well at something doesn't mean that the boys have to do poorly. You know, it's not a zero-sum game, as I was saying before. It's we can all win if we work together.
Yeah, well said. Do you see a difference between men and women when it comes to investing?
Yeah, so I think women are much more prudent. They just take fewer risks. And this has been shown time and again with women fund managers. They make more prudent decisions. They take less risk. And over the long haul, over the really long term, their returns are just as good, if maybe not better. But men are just more motivated to push the envelope and take bigger risks and push for bigger short-term gains. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. You know, if you look at some of the scandals that have happened recently, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried with the crypto thing that he was running. I mean, how many women have ever been brought up on charges doing exactly that, what he did? Not many. I think it's just a different sort of mindset and relationship to risk taking. Men generally are bigger risk takers than women. And I don't know if that's because of the way their brains are wired. Maybe. I didn't go to school for that, so I won't opine on that because I'm not qualified to. But women just tend to, I think, plan better and plan for the long term, which is what ESG is about. Don't forget, it's about really planning for the long term and creating conditions for a future generation to survive and thrive. And if we don't start planning today, we can't do that.
Okay, thank you very much. So to wrap it all up, our traditional magic wand question, what would you do if you had a magic wand with which you could do whatever you please in your professional field over the course of the next 3 years? What would you do for the common good?
Oh, wow. So it's completely unrealistic, but here it goes. Yeah. I would get all the stakeholders around the table and get them to agree that climate action and ESG are important and make them agree to the standards and targets for addressing these changes that we need to make. And finally, no one would leave the table until we have a binding action plan that keeps the planet below the 1.5 degree threshold. And our survival really depends on it. So I wouldn't let anybody go until we agree that we're going to care about this and we're going to actually get serious about doing it.
Okay. If nobody leaves the table, then I would like to be the pizza supplier. Okay, thank you very much. That was a very insightful interview.
Yes, thank you very much, Nicole.
Thank you for having me today.
Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Leaders in Sustainability, a podcast series by Trianon Scientific Communication. If you would like to know more about sustainable development and or corporate social responsibility, please visit www.science-by-trianon.com, where you will find our blog and contact details and where you can subscribe to our newsletter. We are Trianon Scientific Communication. We advise organizations and companies on all matters of sustainability. Our services come as bespoke packages or as easy subscriptions. If you'd like to know more, please visit www.science-by-trianon.com and book a chat with us. In addition, if you are located in Brussels, Belgium, come to one of our regular events and talk to us there. You will find the details of our events on our social media channels, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.